From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in a moment of conversation between two friends who knew each other well, one a woman, one a man. The woman, Susan, informed her friend that, you know, she was starting to be known publicly by using her middle initial, too. That was kind of hard to get used to for her friend who was accustomed to calling her Susan, Susan Anthony. It would take some practice before he could remember to say Susan B. Anthony. He was Frederick Douglass, and this warm, subtle moment is portrayed in the new show at Geneva Theater Center called The Agitators. Why did it stand out to me? Well, because Frederick Douglass and Susan B. Anthony are known as towering historical figures, and for obviously good reason. But the play reminds us that they were people, they were humans, people who tried to occasionally tell jokes, share family stories. They were impacted very personally by their struggles, and they were friends. Frederick Douglass and Susan B. Anthony were friends, but we don't know fully the extent of that relationship. Only about 5 letters between them exist, many others probably burned. They spent a lot of time in the same city, Rochester, of course, so written correspondence wouldn't always have been required. They saw each other a good amount. But isn't it fascinating to ponder that friendship and relationship? It lasted 45 years, and The Agitators gives us a chance to hear them and see them interacting in vivid detail. And the friendship was frayed at times. They agreed on the need for equality, but disagreed on how to get there, or whether it was acceptable for one cause to advance before the other. That could have ended their friendship, but it didn't. And this hour, a chance to meet the people behind this remarkable performance and a look at the history behind The Agitators, which I don't like to advocate, we don't endorse, but you should see it. You really should see it. Cedric Mays is the actor who plays Frederick Douglass in The Agitators. He's amazing. Cedric, it is an honor to have you here. I'm not often nervous, but I felt like I was watching Frederick Douglass. So, I mean, you're amazing, amazing stuff.
Oh, so thank you so much. Really appreciate that.
Madeline Lambert, actor who plays Susan B. Anthony in The Agitators. And, you know, we're going to talk about some of the choices that you and Cedric made in terms of how to present, voice, all the different kinds of things. But I will just say it's an honor to have you as well. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much.
Also, here's Jenny Werner, literary director and resident dramaturg for Geneva Theater Center. Jenny, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And Deborah Hughes is president and CEO of the National Susan B. Anthony Museum and House. Deborah, welcome back to the program for you.
Thank you, Evan.
You've been to the show 3 times?
I have.
You going to go again?
Sure.
Did you feel like me? Did you feel like I'm actually like looking at I'm looking at Susan B. Anthony and Frederick Douglass?
Yeah, I also went to the 2 readings that we did last fall. So I have some familiarity with the play. It's amazing how moving it is and how engaging it is and how you're drawn into the characters.
It is. I mean, I choose words carefully. I don't like the words amazing, incredible. What is it? Not credible, you know, but and many times I felt myself grabbing for those words, primarily because of what Cedric and Madeline were able to do. And Cedric, I kind of want to start with you here and just ask you, I'll ask you both, you know, when you think about being on stage as these towering historical figures, but also giving them humanity, occasionally watching a ball game, telling a joke, you know, and adding that humanity, how did you balance the need to have the intensity of the height of the importance of the character with also the humanity that makes them human?
As I approach these things, you know, you do your background research or, you know, read the biographies that are written on a person. But then at a certain point, you let that stuff go and you just have to realize that they are or were just human beings. You know, they had to eat, they had to sleep, they fell in love, they fell out of love, they challenged themselves, they challenged others. So for me, the more interesting thing was getting beneath the words, getting beneath the biography of a person and trying to figure out how they felt about life, about being alive. And I think out of that comes something human, because that's what we all go through. We all experience those things.
Hmm. Madeline, what do you think?
I agree with Cedric. I think Matt Smart, the playwright, did a really nice job of throughout the process, you know, taking all of this historical content that he spent 2 years researching this play or more, and then just pairing it back to figure out how do they really talk to each other? How do they really talk in the, you know, we have an amazing scene in the play where we are together late at night waiting for slaves to arrive from the Underground Railroad, and we're just 2 friends with our feet in his wrist in a tub and my feet in the tub with him. And how do we find that intimacy between these 2 people?
You did that, and you did it right from the start. I mean, the opening scene, Susan B. Anthony is mildly perturbed that Frederick Douglass won't try. Was it a peach pie? I'm trying to remember.
Peach cobbler.
Peach cobbler. So it's not what you would normally think when you think, what's the first interaction I'm going to get between Frederick Douglass and Susan B. Anthony? And it's humanized from the outset. So I thought it was masterful. And Jenny, why don't you tell us just a little bit of the approach of why you think it was valuable to explore this friendship to begin with, which we knew existed, but you know there has to be some liberties taken because some of the letters that inevitably burned, in other cases that face-to-face interaction didn't require written correspondence. So we have to infer a lot. Why do you think this is an important story to tell?
Well, you know, when we look at these two incredible people from history, these icons of the equal rights movement in this country, their words are so relevant today and so important to hear. We are not taught, if you're not from Rochester, I don't think you know that Frederick Douglass and Susan B. Anthony were friends. I didn't know growing up. And I think you don't know that. So when playwright Matt Smart came to town, we were producing another play of his, and when he learned that they were friends, I think he felt the same way that a lot of people do, that this is a story that we need to tell. We need to understand how, even though they didn't agree with each other all the time, how they remained friends. And I think one of the things that Matt has said frequently is that it's so important to understand how we have conversations with people we don't necessarily agree with 100% of the time. And that's one of the things that Frederick and Susan were able to do. And especially right now, it feels like such an important trait to really be able to have a conversation about something that you might not agree with someone else about.
Part of the focus and one of the central focuses of the play is the 15th Amendment. And what I want to do is ask both performers about this, their portrayal here. And I don't want to preach, but I do want to sort of remember back to January in which, you know, there was the Women's March in Washington and frankly in cities across the country and around the world. And then there was a discussion that flowed out of that in which women of color felt that occasionally white women have left them out or sort of focused the women's rights movement on largely issues that don't always impact women of color. And at times it was tough. And I read some really tough things that women of color wrote about Susan B. Anthony, this idea that maybe she wasn't the ally. Well, this play is unafraid to tackle just how painful it was for both of these characters to struggle with, well, which cause should be first, or why are you fighting for it in a way that might, you know, subjugate our needs? And I thought that was fascinating, and I thought it was hard to walk out of the theater and say that either one of them was wrong or didn't love and care about the other, and that people and equality is complex, and it doesn't always move in a straight line. And I kind of want to start with Cedric and Madeline and ask them both, you know, how much you kind of were aware that you probably had to learn a lot about the characters historically, and how much you wanted the audience to understand and feel the pain that they went through when their relationship strained over the 15th Amendment.
Sure. It's a great question. I think what is challenging is rarely can you sometimes and progressing things forward. It's sometimes hard to get everything at once. Frederick Douglass makes that point in the play, and this thing is very true of today. And what I'm interested in is how this ebb and flow, this back and forth, who gets what first? At the point in the play when the 15th Amendment comes up, we understand that Frederick Douglass at this point has become more of a politician. You know, he understands how the halls of Congress works. And I think that what he was trying to tell Susan was, we're going to get everything, but I've been there. I know what's happening right now. Trust me, we're all fighting towards the same goal, but in ways to manipulate this system that's in place, this is the right way. It's more of a circular path as opposed to a straight line. And I think, to answer your question, I'm sorry, my head was thinking back to what you said earlier about the Women's March in January and these things. I was having a conversation with a friend of mine on the phone on Sunday night about this very thing. And it's interesting, I live in the South Side of Chicago, and I see young black girls who are 10, 11 years old with bodies of women. You know what I mean? And it's happening because possibly, I think, food. You know, the idea of getting a fair lunch, getting food that's not genetically modified and hormones, these kind of things in the food. And to your point of what black women sometimes feel towards the white liberal is that point. Our girls are constantly harassed on the way to bus stops, harassed by grown men, and no one's talking about our girls. And I, once again, living in that neighborhood, I see it all the time, and that's something that irritates me as well. So the question then becomes, yes, this is an issue right now of rights for the majority of women, but what's in my experience from a day-to-day basis is this with these girls. And I think that's exactly what Frederick Douglass was talking about in the play. So that's how I relate it back to from the past to the present. In the time that this comes up in the play, we have Frederick Douglass saying, they are killing us. Black people are the victims. We are the ones being strung up, burned, houses bombed, all these things. We have to get this now because it is a life and death situation. Dire straits are here. And so that's kind of how I tie it in from the past to the present today.
And then there's an interesting moment later in the play where he admits, I thought you would be right behind us.
Absolutely.
And he did, didn't
he? Yeah, he wasn't leaving. That was not the point. The point wasn't that you were never going to get it or that, you know, we're just going to throw you guys off to the side. No, I'm still working in that same direction. But this is a stop on that path to that direction, you know.
And then when he sees that it's not coming and it doesn't come and it doesn't come.
It's heartbreaking, especially to look at your friend now. You're one of your best friends and say, I'm sorry, I was wrong. I thought this was the best route. That's, once again, talking about humanity, that's heartbreaking. For a man to admit that I had your best interest in mind, and it didn't go the way I thought it was, and I am sorry. You know, that's heartbreaking.
Madeline, how do you feel about this, portraying Susan B. Anthony in the play and the frustration that she felt, occasionally the betrayal she felt with Frederick Douglass, because she wanted to do this in lockstep and didn't necessarily see this as, sure, 15th Amendment first, and then we'll be right behind it. She felt in a sense that was the wrong way to go.
Sure. First of all, I'm very interested in the intersection of the personal and the political. I'm not sure how anything political cannot be personal and vice versa. So to me, that's sort of the vein where I enter and think about playing Susan B. Anthony. And you know, right now I'm living in a country where the government wants to regulate my body. And so how can I not feel angry and alive and very, very present to what's happening around me. One of the things that I think you bring up that's really interesting to me is that if there were to be a third character in this play, let's say, maybe it's Ida B. Wells. And I think one thing that Matt does beautifully is he brings Ida into the conversation. And I say, you know, Miss Wells was very critical of me. You know, that she appreciated that I spoke out against discrimination in the North, but does not understand why I let the National Convention happen in Atlanta when black women were not allowed to attend. And the play asked the bigger question, and it asked the question of me as a person, as a human, as an artist, you know, how do we get better at helping each other see? How do we stay in the room with the people we hate and who hate us?
Yeah, this is where that's such a good point. And that criticism of Ida B. Wells of how can that convention happen when women of color can't attend, can't be part of it. And sometimes the compromises that someone like Susan B. Anthony would have to make, the decision you have to make when you see, you know, it's not a straight line to progress. That's the historical value in the agitators that I think the audience will walk out and This moment in 2017 feels a little fraught, or sometimes it feels like, you know, how do you move forward with progress? How do you handle different debates? And sometimes it feels like we use the term purity tests, or these things that, you know, if you can't check every perfect box, or if you don't agree with every step in every order, then you're not on the same team. And Susan B. Anthony and Frederick Douglass were on the same team, and they were friends, and it frayed at times, but it didn't break them. You know, they didn't, at least I think historically, it's fair to say, right? I mean, it frayed them, it didn't break them, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Frederick Douglass was with Susan B. Anthony on the day that he died. He attended a women's council, international women's council, on the day of his death. And I think, you know, his determination to help women gain the vote after the 15th Amendment passed, I mean, we could call him, you know, one of the great early feminists because of his determination to make sure that everyone did have equal rights. And they were, you know, I think a lot has been written about the friendship with Frederick Douglass and a lot of other women in the women's rights movements, and not so much about this. So we are imagining a lot of things because we can't know exactly how close of friends they were. Beyond the, you know, the few letters that we have that survive, and knowing that they were partners in a movement, but I think it's clear that they were good friends and they remained strong allies of each other.
Deborah, what's the message in that for our modern historical moment, our modern moment of having these conversations about what progress means, what rights mean, what equality means, when you look at that friendship, how it frayed but did not break, and then you think back to those tough conversations that women of color often feeling left out, and ways to kind of pull everyone forward together, to work together, and not feel like we have to turn our backs on one another.
I think that's the most amazing thing about the message. The thing that they were completely unified on was about what democracy should be about. That it really is of the people, by the people, for the people. And they both understood that unless you had the power of the vote, that you could never change society. You know, that's the discussion around the 15th Amendment for Frederick Douglass. Almost immediately after the Civil War, they're finding ways to do horrific things to people. Mm-hmm. And how can you change that if you can't be in the positions of power? Susan B. Anthony, at one point during the Civil War, says that she doesn't want to go back to being the country where slavery is allowed, that's a sham. She wants a union that's a union in fact, not a sham. And so here you have these two amazing leaders who are talking about a vision for democracy we haven't achieved yet. They disagreed on how to get there. And they're, you know, if you look at them personally, they're flawed human beings. I'm not a believer in idolizing any person. But their passion and their commitment and their consistency for an entire lifetime of trying to do what would build a better country for all people. And often they got confronted on their own hypocrisies. You know, we were not as enlightened in the 19th century as we are now, but we're not as enlightened as I thought we were a year ago.
We're talking about The Agitators, which runs through November 12th at Jeebus Theater Center. The remarkable performance had its world premiere here in Rochester, and again, it explores that 45-year friendship between Frederick Douglass and Susan B. Anthony. You're hearing Deborah Hughes, President and CEO of the National Susan B. Anthony Museum and House, Jenny Werner, Literary Director and Resident Dramaturg for Jeeva Theater Center, and the performers who play Frederick Douglass and Susan B. Anthony, Cedric Mays and Madeline Lambert, are here. And when you see them, it's gripping. I mean, I saw people crying in the audience and feel like they are seeing the character. We'll lighten it up a little in our second half hour, don't worry, but I do want to keep it a little on the serious side for a moment, because something happened last night that a lot of people are talking about today, and I think this dovetails with why this performance is so relevant right now. So 45-year friendship, the first year that we the play opens in, what's the year that it opens?
It's 1849.
All right, it's 1849. So obviously we're not quite on the eve of the Civil War. Well, it was last night that General John Kelly made some comments on Fox News about General Robert E. Lee and the cause of the Civil War. It's 2017, and this is one of President Trump's most trusted advisors and chief of staff, and a lot of people have said, you know, the person in the White House who's sort of a grounding agent to kind of keep things calm at times. Well, this is what General Kelly said about Robert E. Lee and the Civil War.
Robert E. Lee was an honorable man. He was a man that gave up his country to fight for his state, which in 150 years ago was more important than country. It was always loyalty to state first back in those days. Now it's different today. But the lack of an ability to compromise led to the Civil War. And men and women of good faith on both sides made their stand.
men and women of good faith on both sides. Both sides made their stand, and it called him Robert E. Lee an honorable man. Just want to point out, Adam Serwer's piece in The Atlantic is worth reading. Ta-Nehisi Coates linked to it again this morning. Probably should have it bookmarked in case we ever need to talk about Robert E. Lee. He believed in the torture of people of color, and that happened. But anyway, let me just back off and ask. I'll start with Cedric. When you hear Chief of Staff of the White House talking about the Civil War and Robert E. Lee that way.
I'm from South Carolina. The Confederate flag was on my state building for most of my childhood until it was moved a little closer so we could see it a little better on the state grounds, because that was a compromise. You understand? I come from a place where plantations are places now where people have their weddings. They book their weddings at places where people of color were maimed, tortured, beat within an inch of their lives, and subjugated. Forgive me for not finding anything honorable in Robert E. Lee. He was a traitor to this country and for what it stands for. And if you are a Confederate supporter, you are a traitor to the United States of America. I said it, and I stand by it. There is no compromise. Good people on both sides, yes, just like in this past summer where these neo-Nazis are waving flags. Yeah, there are some good people on both sides. No, they're not. They're evil people who should be put down, period.
Jenny, is that a reminder of why this performance, the agitators, these themes, you know, as much as we want to think that 150 years later, it's an entirely different world. The echoes are still there.
It's not just the echoes that are still there. I mean, I think a lot. If you look at the speeches of Douglas and Anthony, we will see the roots of a lot of the activism today. Words of incredible orators today. I mean, for someone who is a leader in this country to go back to the, you know, what I remember being taught in history classes in school, that the Civil War was an issue of states' rights, is ludicrous. I think. I mean, it was a war about slavery, and people's desire to own other people, and I absolutely think that if we can't learn anything from history, then the most important thing we can do is find other ways to tell that history today. And it is absolutely why we need this play today, and why we need to be hearing about the complexity and the ways that Frederick and Susan and others dealt with the incredible complexity around these issues, and how you work to create a better country for all of us, because this is a country that is supposed to be a country for us all, to be equals. And if we can't, you know, if we can't achieve that in our leadership, I don't have a lot of hope for this country. But I have to say that it is this play that over the last year that we've been working on it, it's this play that has given me hope for this country. And looking to the difficult conversations that these two and other people in this time period had about the dreams that they had for what this country could be, that's what gives me hope now. And I just hope that someday we can achieve that.
Madeline?
One thing that Frederick Douglass says that I think about a lot is, we have to do with the past only as we can make it useful to the present and to the future. So how are we using our past to affect change and move forward? How do we use what we know about what happened during the Civil War to advance and progress and make change? So I think about his words a lot. One thing that really gives me hope is that we are doing this performance for middle schoolers and high schoolers, and it's deeply encouraging to see them lean forward in their seats and understand what these two people did so that they can vote.
Wow. We're going to get our only break of the hour, and we're going to come back. If you want to weigh in with your thoughts on these various themes we've been discussing, you can do that. You can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program, connections@WXXI.org. You can find us on social media. And if you're cynical about social media, I get it, but this is the day that you want to jump on and see what Ta-Nehisi Coates had to say about the idea of compromise. I mean, you heard Cedric say there is no compromise when it comes to slavery. But Ta-Nehisi Coates points out not only is that a sad idea that we just didn't compromise enough to avoid the Civil War, but what is compromise if not telling people that they are three-fifths of a human being? And what we so often did actually do, white people in power, that were forms of compromise that took rights away. It's worth reading him on Twitter today, Ta-Nehisi Coates, just for some of that historical perspective. So, but we're going to talk about some other things with Cedric Mays and Madeline Lambert, who play Frederick Douglass and Susan B. Anthony in The Agitators. We're going to talk about their approach to actually putting the human face on stage, either whether it's the voice or the approach, how much of that is sort of their own creation, how much they try to kind of glean from what we know. Fascinating stuff. The Agitators runs through November 12th, and we'll continue the discussion next on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, in our first hour, we examine U.S. foreign policy in relation to Mexico and Central America, an often unexplored subject. We'll tackle it in detail. Then in our second hour, is there a craft beer bubble? Is it about to burst? Well, maybe not. We're looking at the local scene, the growth, and the future of craft beer. That's all coming up Wednesday.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Hosmer Winery, making wines from estate-grown grapes since 1985. On the west side of Cayuga Lake in the Finger Lakes region, varietals include Rieslings, Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, and more. Information online at hosmerwinery.com.
Baltimore is in the middle of a police reform effort, trying to curb excessive force and unconstitutional stops. Some residents think that's made police too cautious.
People are less concerned about police reform right now than they are about their own public safety. Being able to walk out our houses without being afraid of being shot.
That story and the special counsel's Russia investigation this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. In our brief break, I was asking Cedric Mays, the actor who plays Frederick Douglass in The Agitators, you know, should we take our discussion a little lighter direction? Because there are light moments in the play. In fact, your comic timing, both of you, is really good. There was a laugh-out-loud moment where I think you're trying to tell a joke, and Madeline, who plays Susan B. Anthony, said, you know, something like, "We are not funny," or what was the line?
I do. Well, we tell some bad jokes, and then I say, "We are not funny," and you say,
"We are hilarious."
And then I go,
I remember that moment because, first of all, both of your timing is really, really good, and I don't know if timing can be taught. I don't know. I have no idea because I don't have it. But I also wonder, even though it's a small moment, Madeline, are those important moments to, again, continue to remind us that we've got these intense struggles? But peel it back here. These are two human beings like the rest of us.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't know how, and Deborah, maybe you can shed some light on this. I'm not sure how you do what Susan did without a sense of humor. Mm. I don't know how you have resilience without a great sense of humor. And I think a lot of these great iconic leaders do. Otherwise, how do they get up in the morning and, you know, travel through Kansas, you know, with no money and do the kind of grassroots work that they did?
The images we have of Susan, people often comment she looks pretty stern, but all of the descriptions, she was delightful, witty, sharp, engaging. This is a woman that would come back and stay with you over and over again when she came back to speak again and again. She had a great charisma and sense of that.
All people look stern in photographs at those times,
of course,
by the way.
Yes.
Photographs took forever.
Yes, correct.
And the smiling looked weak, I think. I may be totally wrong, but I think there's something historically accurate about this. That was just sort of the way.
Yeah, and when Stanton meets her the first time, she comments about her amazing smile. And I think it's interesting to me we've gotten reactions at the museum about how people feel about the way Susan's portrayed. And we've gotten some very extreme reactions from people about that, which is just really interesting. I think Matt had such an incredible challenge to deal with content that's so timely and to take this really complicated story and put it into 2 hours and 15 minutes, but then also to take icons where people have all kinds of things they've imagined and to put those into people and characters. And I think that's for some people, it's not who they expected. For other people, it's right on.
You mean they almost expected the stern sort of caricature that we have of Susan B. Anthony?
No, but they clearly had some expectation about it, whether it's dress or carriage or tone, or it feels like people have imagined a lot of Susan B. Anthony, and they're pretty tightly bonded to that.
Sure. Well, Madeline, how much did you kind of consider the images, the ideas, what was described about Susan B. Anthony over the years versus, you know, whatever interpretation you're going to bring to a character over a 45, because the play begins and she's 29?
Correct.
29. So it's 45 years of her life starting at 29. How did you approach that?
Well, I certainly, you know, we have her writings. We have the houses here. And I went to the house. I actually went incognito to the house. So I got the full effect, the wonderful tour that they have. You know, I can glean as much as I can from the writing and the history. But there's no video recording of her. We don't know what her voice sounded like. So ultimately, I have to go with what I know as a woman living now, and where do I find the intersection of, you know, her life and what I know to be her truth and my own life and truth. So that's how I approached it.
What about you when it comes to Cedric, when it comes to putting a face, a voice to mm-hmm. Frederick Douglass?
Well, it's interesting. You know, reading his autobiographies, I'm sorry, I found out that he was actually a preacher at certain points, or was at least desired to go into the ministry. And I'm, like, once again, born and raised in the South, and I'm born and raised in the Black church. And I wanted to be a preacher at one point in my life. And so I'm very familiar with that tone of the preacher, the Southern Black preacher, especially if he's Baptist. So when I started thinking about Frederick Douglass, and once again, you kind of look at the images so much, and you kind of, for me anyway, my imagination starts to wander because I'm looking at his face like, what do those bones in his face do? Because he had these great features. And I'm like, I wonder how the muscles of his face moved. And so as I began to somehow craft sound and character, I'm once again just using my imagination to figure out kind of how the muscles of his body worked to produce the sound that he produced. And I could be totally off. Like Madeline said, you know, there's no recording of it. But in terms of just going from what he wrote about himself, and then you begin to hear how a person sounds in their writing, and he wrote so much that, you know, once again, my imagination started to wander again, just how does he put words together, and how do those sounds then affect words, and which then informs my job as an actor to create character. So,
and one of the things for me, I mean, I know that, you know, Susan grew up in a Quaker household, mm-hmm. and she had a father that, for that time, championed women, and I knew that there was a sort of baseline strength and tenacity mm-hmm. to her voice,
yeah.
and a fearlessness yeah. that is inherent, I think, to both of these mm-hmm. individuals.
Mm-hmm. When you see the agitators, if you're in the camp that, as Deborah Hughes describes, had an expectation that maybe Susan B. Anthony would be sterner or wouldn't have this occasional sense of humor, or have this warmth at times here. There are historical reasons, even though there weren't a lot of letters between Frederick Douglass and Susan B. Anthony that survive. Susan B. Anthony's writings are political, but there are letters in the Department of Rare Books and Special Collections at the University of Rochester that show a tender side, right? I mean, the letters to Rachel Foster Avery, who was kind of like a daughter to her. I mean, that shows some of the... Is that fair?
Yeah, although one of my favorite letters that we have that she wrote in the 1850s when she was out on the family farm, she is sharing condolences with a cousin. And it's this, Susan, you didn't meet, it's so gentle, where she's talking about, you know, you're going to miss her, you're going to hear the patter of her feet, she's not going to be at your table for years, you're going to take her little gown out and shed tears. We think she's actually describing how her mother had responded to the loss of her sister, Eliza. But then she gets about halfway through the letter, and you turn over the page, and she says, But your loss will never be like the loss of the slave woman who sees her child sold on the chopping block off to go to the hands of the master. You'll never have the kind of pain that that mother would have and that kind of loss. And then she goes a whole page and a half against slavery and really saying, you've got this really tender Susan, and she's still poetic. Mm-hmm. There's also more around a faith perspective. And then you have Susan, who also is always engaged with society.
Amazing. Jenny, thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I don't know how to put it any better than Deborah just did, but I think that there is that the connection, like Madeline was saying earlier, of the personal and the political. And I think that these are two incredibly charismatic people who, in order to get people to help with their causes, of course, they had to be charismatic and interesting. And so I think that's absolutely a part of their lives. We also know that, Susan, during the days of the Political Equality Club in Rochester, had people over to the house and cooked like these huge banquets, and she was a hostess and trying to lead these incredible meetings. And so we see both sides of both of them. I think that they are, there are things that they in their writings and in their personal correspondence are witty and tender, and also incredibly moving and inspirational.
You'll even see them at a baseball game, though the rules were really different, right?
I'm like, oh, no.
Eventually, so I'm watching the scene.
Ask me about the baseball rules.
Frederick Douglass and Susan B. Anthony watching a baseball game, and then I'm going, wait, what year would this have been? And the rules keep cycling. The dialogue reflects the fact that baseball was very different then, too.
Oh, yeah. It keeps changing. The funny thing about I discovered about baseball was that maybe about at least 10, 20 years before that scene, the rule was you could throw the ball at somebody and that would be an out. So if you hit somebody with the ball, it's like, that's a baseball. If you get hit by it today, you're going to really injure somebody, but you could actually throw somebody, bam, and hit them on the shoulder. That's an out. No, man, you almost just dislocated my arm, man. But it's not the rules. They're always changing, which is interesting in that scene, actually, talking about the personal and the political. Frederick has a line and he says, Susan says, it would seem some simplification of the rules
would be helpful.
and his rebuttal is, oh, they are always changing the rules. They will get it right one of these days. I think it's so interesting, that choice of language. It's not just about the game. It's about everything, you know.
Yeah.
That was another, by the way, devastatingly well-timed line from Madeline, from from Susan. Simplification of the rules would...
Sure.
What's the actual line?
It would seem some simplification of the rules would be helpful.
Yes, yes. Which we can all relate to, but Cedric's right. The follow-up line takes it well beyond baseball. Let me get a couple of listener comments. Joel writes to the program and says, historian David Rodinger's excellent book, Seizing Freedom, as well as his writings about the problem of solidarity, describe these very struggles. And your guest is exactly right. He wrote that at the moment Cedric was... letting us know his thoughts about General Kelly's comments last night. Joel says the states' rights argument is not accurate, and of course not, but it is amazing that we're sitting here doing this in 2017, that we're still having this conversation. And Robert writes to the program and just says, it seems we will always have this either a misunderstanding or what appears to be an intentional misunderstanding of history. I don't know why we see Confederate flags in the North to begin with, but it's 2017. When will it end? That's from Robert. Cedric, can I ask you a little bit more about that? The lessons of the Civil War. Not only are we still talking about it or still debating it, I guess, with people in power, but Robert's email's right. We see Confederate flags and Confederate statues in northern states that were constructed in the last 100 years or so. What does that mean to you?
History is history. I don't have a problem with history. It happened, you know. I think the problem is when people begin to perpetuate things as if the past was right, the bad things that happened were right, and they seek to vindicate it in some kind of way. That's the problem. Yes, slavery happened. Yes, Christopher Columbus came here and the Native Americans were here and the Native Americans were wiped out. These things happened. Let's talk about them in a very honest way, because history is a living thing. It's not, they're not just dead facts. You know, what I did yesterday will affect me today and will affect me for the rest of my life. So if we were to actually begin to really discuss history in a way that is useful, as they said, you know, then we may not be so prone to repeat the same mistakes over and over. But the problem is, I think, that certain people, obviously, who are in power, want those same mistakes repeated over and over because it keeps them in power. It keeps that system in place. And let's not mince words here. The institution of slavery is still a working institution today. And that's why it is, has maintained its stance in this country. Because the same way that the slave master handled his plantation is the same way that people in power handle employees and workers today. Healthcare, somebody. Slaves didn't have it. We're not paying for that. If you get maimed, well, you just go off and limp off and die somewhere. Isn't that what happens today? Companies don't want to give their employees a fair insurance package, because if this employee gets hurt or sick or needs to have a maternal leave from the job, it's the same system. We just call it a different thing. That's history.
Why do you think we are in that cycle then? I mean, actually, let me shift this question, because Stephen Colbert had Ta-Nehisi Coates on the program and asked him what gives him hope. And Ta-Nehisi Coates kind of bristled and said, it is not my job to give anyone hope, and I don't have a lot of hope. And he referenced that again today online when he was referring to General Kelly. You know, why does he not have a lot of hope? It's because it's 150 years later, and here we are, you know, still debating, well, is this white supremacy? Is this white nationalism? Is this really inequality? Or that offends me when you say that, as opposed to understanding the real history, not only that happened, but that maybe moves through us today. So are you hopeful?
Sure. I'm very hopeful.
You are.
I'm hopeful, because I guess for me, I couldn't get out of bed in the morning if I didn't believe in the human spirit. You know, I believe there is something innately good about people. Maybe I'm naive, I don't know, but I just believe that. But to answer an earlier question that you posed, though, I think that the real solution is to not just show that black folks or minorities are the ones being affected, but we all are being affected. Let's look at those mining towns in West Virginia, where these folks want to bring back those good old jobs with digging coal and stuff like that. The coal is gone. President Obama introduced a plan that said, we're going to teach you the skills of tomorrow. But this is how strong racism is. Racism trumps reason. It does. And that's the baffling part. Here is a plan that's good for everybody. Not just one group of people, but for everybody. But racism said, because a black man is given to you, no, you don't want to do that. See, he ain't got your best interest in mind. That's lunacy. It's crazy. And I don't understand how you teach someone that.
I'm looking at, you know, my son's kindergarten class now, and I think you'd have to teach someone to really hate at the level that we've had throughout our history. But I also sit in the position of privilege there. You know, I mean, I haven't had to feel what you just described, you know, someone in a position of leadership having their ideas rejected because of their race. And I suspect, Cedric, you know, there have been times in your life where you feel, of course, that you've had, you've either haven't been listened to, haven't been included in conversations, have been disrespected, or worse, because of your race. I mean, that's not something that I have experienced. So that's a position of privilege. But I look at kids now, and I think, when do we start talking about this? What do we tell them? I mean, I won't relay on the air, but I've got a 5.5-year-old. We've had some interesting conversations lately. But you know, you feel like, how blunt do we want to be? How much do they need to know? And how do you create a world where we can get out of that cycle?
Well, I look at someone like Dylann Roof, you know, from Charleston, who mm-hmm. massacred the church in Charleston. Dylann Roof is younger than me, and we're from basically the same part of the country. And I tell people this, and people think it's kind of crazy, but it's very true. My brothers and I are the first ones in our family to go all 12 years through high school in a completely integrated school, you know? And so, obviously, Dylan Roof went through the same thing. So, well, I bring it up because here's a kid who obviously had black friends. He probably fell down on the playground when he was 5 years old, and a little black kid or a little black girl or boy picked him up and said, hey, man, it's okay, you'll feel better, and helped him out and encouraged him in some kind of way. But somewhere along the line, he was told something else about black people. And so children aren't born hating people. They aren't born hating someone because they're a woman or a man or because they are black or white. It doesn't matter. Can you play? Okay, let's play. You know, and that's as simple as that. But somewhere along the line, we begin to teach them something. It's not just so much that someone sitting you down and teaching you something. We teach them through our actions. We teach them through how we behave towards other people. And they pick up on that more so than what we say to them. So maybe the solution is, if adults start being better people, children will start being better people.
Jenny?
Well, I was just to sort of support what you're saying, Cedric. I think also that it's not just about teaching children, but it's about dismantling some of the systems that are in place.
Absolutely.
that kids can't do anything about. You know, but there are some systems that are in place that that are about not only disenfranchising, but just putting some people ahead of others. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I think Susan B. Anthony and Frederick Douglass were you know, heroes of is their ability to attack those systems. Mm-hmm. And I think that those are the things that we have to look at. We have to keep teaching kids to treat everyone equally and fairness and all of those kinds of things. But we also have to attack the systems that are put in place that don't treat each other, that don't treat everyone equally and on a level playing field.
The Agitators runs through November 12th at Jiva Theater. JivaTheater.org. Tickets start at $25. Jump online to learn more about that. And it is a remarkable two-person performance. And you're hearing from the actors who play, Frederick Douglass and Susan B. Anthony. And I'd like to start to close the hour by asking both of you what you've heard from people who have seen the performance. Now, Madeline, what have you heard from people about your portrayal in the performance?
I've actually, in one of the post-show conversations this weekend, a woman stood up and said, this play is giving me hope. And she was very emotional. She had tears in her eyes. And she said, we live in a time where I don't know what to do. And it can feel paralyzed. And she said, seeing this story and this friendship really gave me hope. And I think for people to see a white woman and a black man have an intimate, extraordinary, complicated friendship is really hopeful, because I still think that's very rare to see. And for me, it's been transformative to become friends with Cedric. It's changed my own biases.
Cedric, what about you? What have you heard from people who have seen the performance?
So I was going to mention the same thing, actually, because that same woman that you mentioned was just so inspiring. And you know, it's something, once again, that we don't really think about so much because we live in a time we do. A black man, a white woman, just being friends and just having really great conversations and talking about how we can change the world together. It's like we have a running joke, like Susie B and Freddie D are like these superheroes, you know, like Wonder Twins. Here we go, you know. And I think that is what I've heard a lot of, really, is that the fact that here are two people who, yeah, they had different agendas at certain times, but that's just human beings. People do that. People have different interests. But when it came down to it, she always had Frederick Douglass's back, and he'd always had hers. And I think most of the people walking out with that story in particular, that friends fight. Friends have arguments. They'll blow up, talk for years. You want to get something to eat? Yeah, let's go. You know? That's kind of how friendships work. And, yeah, that's what I've been hearing.
Does that give you a sense that whatever the cause of the moment is now, that we can have coalitions of people that work together from very different backgrounds, even if occasionally they disagree on the methods of the moments or the ideas?
I think it's absolutely necessary. I mean, we at the end of the day, we're all fighting the same thing, you know? And I think the end goal is that all people are enfranchised. Everyone has a voice. Everyone's at the table, and everyone's being represented. And how can we help one another? If that is the end goal, then that work starts before we get to the goal line. You know what I mean? It starts with us working together right now on attacking the problem so that when we get to the table, we can efficiently work together.
I know about our last minute. I'll ask both of you then, maybe 30 seconds each. Just the weight of playing this historical character. How has it been for you? Do you get asked? Tedrick's going to ask Madeline first.
It's given me motivation as a woman, as an artist. Learning about her has changed my life. And I truly mean that. Her sense of relentlessness, her tirelessness, her humanness. I'm forever grateful for the opportunity.
Cedric?
Same here. I mean, it's just changed me in the sense that, you know, playing a character like this, you know, you try to get under their skin and really begin to believe and understand who they are in their soul. And there's just something so resilient about him. I mean, there's something that just, and both of them, that they just keep driving forward. They just can't stop. And I love that attitude because that's what life is, I think. For me personally, that's what I believe, is that, you know, you're always reaching, as Paul says in the book, I forgot what book of the Bible, but pressing towards that higher mark. And I think that's what it is. These two people embody that, constantly pressing towards a higher mark. And yeah, that's what I take away.
Cedric Mays plays Frederick Douglass, Madeline Lambert, Susan B. Anthony in The Agitators, which you can see now through November 12th. Jenny Warner, Literary Director and Resident Dramaturg for Jiva Theater Center, behind this remarkable performance. And Deborah Hughes, President and CEO of the National Susan B. Anthony Museum and House. Thanks to all of you for being here. And thank you for what you have brought to the stage. It was moving to see it myself, and I know many of our listeners are going to be there to see you before you're done on November 12th. Thank you all for being here.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, jivatheater.org for more information. There are thanks to Rob Braden behind the glass, Audrey Sample, Megan Mack. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon, and we're back with you Wednesday on member-supported public radio.